Despite Republican efforts to dismantle the Affordable Care Act, it is still in effect. Open enrollment runs through December 15th, so if you're looking for coverage or if you're thinking about changing your current plan, now is the time to do it. A lot of people are confused because the Trump administration slashed funding for marketing and the organizations that hire people to offer assistance during the sign-up process. On today's Your Call, we will take your questions about the ACA. How much do plans cost and how comprehensive is the coverage? Join us after the news. Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Open enrollment for the Affordable Care Act runs through December 15th. So if you're looking for insurance for the first time or you're thinking about changing your plan, now is the time to do it. There's a lot of confusion around the ACA. According to a recent survey of roughly 1,000 people, 38% said they did not know that the ACA is still in effect. Despite Republican attempts to dismantle it, the ACA is still in effect. But the Trump administration has slashed funding for marketing and for the groups that hire people to help during the sign-up process. According to Kaiser Health News, the administration is spending a total of just $10 million. That is far less than the $100 million spent by the Obama administration. And marketing and outreach really does make a difference. This year's open enrollment period has seen 400,000 fewer signups compared with this time last year, but almost 2 million plans have been selected since open enrollment began on November 1st. Some of the plans are dropping in price, but a lot of people are posting on social media that they just cannot afford the price of so many of the plans. So today we're going to take your questions. How much do these plans cost? What kind of coverage is available? Is any of it comprehensive? In fact, why don't we open the lines now? Because I know that when we do these shows, so many of you have questions about the ACA. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Today, we're joined by Jordan Rao, senior correspondent for Kaiser Health News, a nonprofit news service committed to in-depth coverage of health care policy and politics. It's editorially independent of the Kaiser Family Foundation. Hi, Jordan. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. Thank you. Trudy Lieberman is contributing editor for the Columbia Journalism Review and lead writer for CJR's blog covering the healthcare fight. Trudy is also a writer for Health News Review and the Center for Health Journalism. Hi, Trudy. Thank you for joining us. Welcome back to the show.
Hi. Thank you.
Well, Trudy, you have been on the show for many, many years now talking about the healthcare crisis in this country and the ACA. So given where we are right now, it's almost 2019, the Republicans have tried really hard to dismantle the ACA. It is still in effect. There's still so much confusion around the ACA and what's available. I mean, what is your analysis right now? Where are we with the ACA?
Well, I think the law still exists in some form. I mean, it's been wounded somewhat by some of the actions of the administration. But people can still find insurance on the state shopping exchanges. And I think that most of us would probably recommend that people start their search there, that there are some ways that you can get a good policy still shopping on your state exchange. The problem is that the prices in many areas are still very high. Even though when we look at the whole range of insurance that's being offered through the marketplaces this year, some of the prices have come down and they're a little bit more manageable than they have been in the past. But when you look at individual policies, say in an individual state for an individual person, that person is likely to find a policy that still is pretty expensive for them. And those policies are still going to be expensive if the family does not qualify for a subsidy. The subsidies are still in place that families at the lower income levels, below 400% of the federal poverty level, can still get subsidies, and those subsidies are a real godsend to many families because without them they wouldn't be able to afford the premium at all. But the problem exists for families whose incomes are above that threshold. And just to give you an idea, that a family of four with an income of more than $100,400 is not going to be eligible for a subsidy. And so when you consider the prices of some of these policies, plus the out-of-pocket maximums for 2019 at $15,000 plus for a family policy, the family is making a calculation that maybe they're not going to be able to afford health insurance. And that's where the problem is coming in, that these families really don't have a lifeline, as do those at the lower ends of the income spectrum.
Right, and obviously for so many reasons, price is such an important part of all of this. Some people just cannot afford these plans. I mean, Jordan, you wrote a piece just recently called "In Health Insurance Wastelands, Rosier Options Crop Up for 2019. And you point out in the newly competitive market in Memphis, the cheapest mid-level silver plan for next year will cost almost $500 a month for a 40-year-old. It's a 17% decrease, but still, that's so much money, $500 a month for a 40-year-old.
Yeah, I mean, I completely agree with everything that Trudy said. And, you know, the this whole law has sort of emerged from the Republican effort to dismantle it and replace it last year, you know, a little bit like Bruce Willis in Die Hard. You know, it's charred and messed up, but it's still sort of kicking. Mm-hmm. But the fundamental problems with it that were at the beginning, which was a limit on how it was going to contain costs and also the degree of financial support it was going to give people to buy insurance, those are still there and they haven't been fixed. And so you have in this market, just like you have for people who get their insurance through their employers, you have costs increasing every year well above the level of inflation.
So can we talk more about pricing? Talk about how it actually works, why it goes up in some places, why it goes down in other places.
Sure. Well, California is actually a great example of how pricing works. So insurance in Northern California, particularly in the Bay Area, is significantly higher than insurance in Southern California. So why is that? The primary reason is because in Northern California, the hospitals and doctors have organized into large groups and systems, and they're more able to dictate their prices to the insurers. The insurers have less leverage. And in Southern California, it's more diffuse. So it comes down to this market play that goes on that, you know, as a consumer, you don't see. But each year, each plan is going to negotiate with the hospital systems around it and with the doctors, and they try and come up with a rate. And if you come to agreement, then you're in network. And if you don't come to agreement, then the insurer isn't going to cover you or will offer significantly less. And so that relationship hasn't changed at all, but that's what really drives prices in a lot of the most expensive areas. The other thing that drives them is if there aren't a lot of insurers and they pull out. Now, sometimes if you go down to just one insurer, then the insurer has a really big market advantage. But if you have monopolies of either on the insurer side or on the provider side, then you're going to have more likely to have higher prices.
Trudy, what else would you add about prices and what determines the price?
Well, when the pricing actuary at an insurance company sits down to figure the price for the next year, he or she looks at a number of factors. And certainly the market power of the providers in an area, as Jordan described it, is one of the factors that they look at. They also look at something called trend, and that's sort of the actuarial term that defines what the general price increase for medical services has been over the year. So the actuaries will look at whether the overall prices have increased or decreased. And if the medical trend has increased, which is pretty much the case these days, then there are factors that go into the pricing of the policy that account for that particular trend. There's another thing that's been driving the price of the Obamacare policies for most of its life right now, and that's been the uncertainty surrounding the law. And because insurance companies have not exactly been sure of what's going to happen politically to the law, they have often put in a cushion, so to speak, to cushion themselves if the politics sort of went in a bad direction for them. And so I think sometimes that's what's been going on. They've put in a little bit of extra so that they can still make their profit goals or their pricing goals or whatever their goals happen to be, given the uncertainty of the marketplace, which has really been a very big factor for them. Now, it's hard to say that the marketplace has really stabilized a whole lot. Some people would argue that it is more stable now than it has been, say, in 2014, 2015, when the markets were pretty unstable and insurance companies didn't know what was happening. And I've had actuaries tell me earlier this year that they really were expecting decreases in some markets because they felt, the companies felt more confident that the they're not going to have the rug pulled out from under them. So all of this goes into a big mix, and what comes out is the price that the actuary tells the company that they can sell the product at. And then, of course, the company has marketing expense and sales expense and those sorts of things that go in, and of course that's also part of the premium that somebody pays. So that when it comes down to the consumer level, we see some of these very high prices, like Memphis, to use the example of that Jordan was using. The one that I thought was rather astonishing was for the 40-year-old family not getting a subsidy. They would be paying about $19,000 a year, and I'm thinking, what kind of family can possibly afford that? Take the family with $100,000 of income at 400% of poverty, that's one-fifth of their income is going to health insurance. And I doubt if many families are going to be able to afford that. So that's kind of the bind that they find themselves in this year. And then on top of that, the out-of-pocket maximums, which are written into the law that there has to be these out-of-pocket limits, keep going up every year. Mm. Now, the limits this year for a family policy are $15,800. But who has the cash on hand in the event of a severe illness to pay $16,000 out-of-pocket? I mean, that's really, you know, steep for most families. And I believe there are studies from the Commonwealth Fund that showed most families couldn't even afford $1,000 expense out of pocket. So you see that families are really in a bind when it comes to paying for health insurance.
Wow. Trudy Lieberman is contributing editor for the Columbia Journalism Review and lead writer for CJR's blog covering the healthcare fight. Jordan Rao is senior correspondent for Kaiser Health News, a nonprofit news service committed to in-depth coverage of healthcare policy and politics. They are independent from the Kaiser Family Foundation. And today we're talking about healthcare. Open enrollment for the Affordable Care Act runs through December 15th. So if you're looking for insurance or if you're thinking about changing your plan, now is the time to do it. If you have any questions or comments, we'd love to hear from you. Those of you who have signed up with the ACA, how much are you paying? How comprehensive is the coverage? What has your experience been like? And if you looked for a plan that might be better or cheaper, what has that experience been like? I mean, it's just so out of reach for so many people. You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. You know, Jordan, these details are so important, but really, at the end of the day, people just, they want comprehensive health care. They want to know that if they get sick or if there's an emergency, they won't go bankrupt. And I'd love to find out what have been the major differences in the way that these health insurance companies price their plans and what they offer under, say, Obama and under Trump, because Axios just had a story, and it says, as of August 2nd, 85 publicly traded healthcare companies have amassed $47 billion of global profit, $545 billion of global revenue just in the second quarter. I mean, these companies are just making massive profits, and their profits, you know, obviously went up because of the cut in corporate taxes from the Republicans. But what changes do you see with these health insurance companies under different administrations, or are there any changes?
Well, so far, I mean, the changes were mostly not enacted. So these markets are not that different than they were, with a couple of things that are weedy enough to avoid for now. They're not that different under Trump than they were under Obama. I think that for consumers, the big difference is that they become increasingly narrow in their selection of providers, which means that, you know, 20 years ago, you would be most likely to get, you know, a plan that would give you access, would have relationships with a lot of different doctors and hospitals, and you could really pick and choose. And the hallmark of these plans over the years has increasingly been narrow networks where the plan will cut a deal with just one hospital system or one doctor system. And therefore, for a consumer, that has two important repercussions. The first is you don't want to just shop by price alone because you can get what you think is a great deal, and then you can find out that, you know, it's the hospital on the other side of town or it doesn't have any of the doctors that you like. And that is, you know, shopping and figuring out who's in and who's out of your network makes shopping for price look easy because it's incredibly difficult. The lists are sometimes not up to date. And of course, it's almost impossible to predict what type of doctor you're going to need in a lot of cases in the coming year. And so that has been sort of a continuing problem. And that is, you know, I've given up making predictions on anything after the last couple of years of world events. You know, if there's something that you would think or want would be addressed that could be addressed potentially on a less politically frenzied basis, it might be that issue because that affects everybody and nobody likes, you know, being that restricted.
Trudy, what would you add?
Well, I think that the mistake a lot of people make is going into the marketplace, and I think it's really important this year because we have all these new kinds of products on the market that the Trump administration allowed, like these short-term plans that really are not so short-term. They can go as long as 3 years. But the problem of the networks is very pronounced in some of these short-term plans because one of the ways that the sellers of these plans get their price down is that they really do restrict the networks. And so people don't have much of a choice. So perhaps you have, say, mental health issues. You may find that the network does not really have a lot of providers that can deal with the problem you have, or that you have to go clear across the county to get a provider for pediatric care for your child. So I think that people have to be really careful about the networks that they go into. And I've thought about this question a lot about how do I advise people, how do other journalists advise people about what they should choose. And I think it comes down to how much risk you're willing to take in the final analysis. I think if you're really a very risk-averse person, you would probably want to buy the most comprehensive policy with the widest possible network that you could find because you're going to be protected when something terrible and unforeseen happens, and we know that it does happen. On the other hand, if you're sort of, you know, devil may care and you're willing to take a chance, then perhaps some of these short-term policies that are going to be a lot less expensive but may not cover you for very much, they're going to be a lot less coverage, less price involved. Maybe that's going to be okay, and maybe, you know, you can don't have to worry about it. You know, you think I'm never going to get sick. But I think you have to think about how much risk you're really willing to take. If you think you can pay for a very costly illness out of pocket, then you can take a chance. But my guess is most families can't. And so that's the first thing I always advise people to think about, is how risk-averse are they and how much risk are they willing to take? And then start looking at the network and the out-of-pocket costs and all of those other things that we have talked about.
And what is the way to, like, how do you know how comprehensive the plan is? A friend posted yesterday on Facebook that she's searching for a plan. She lives in Monterey County, and so this is Blue Shield of California. I mean, these prices are crazy to me. The bronze PPO, $775. The platinum PPO, $1,590 a month. And the difference is like her primary care visit would be $75 with the cheapest plan, which is $775 a month, and then the primary care visit with the high plan would be $15. and they show the generic drug costs, the yearly deductible, all of that. But how else do you know how good these plans are?
Well, it seems to me that the high-priced plan must be offering more than that. I think she should look very carefully at what else it's offering. This is a platinum plan, you said?
Yes.
Yeah, that is covering, is it 90%, Jordan, of all the costs?
I think so.
Is that the number?
It may even be higher, or is that gold? In any case, it's covering the vast, vast majority of the costs, and so this person's going to pay less, most likely, in terms of if they do go to the doctor, in terms of out-of-pocket costs, and might not run up their whole deductible.
And so that person is probably very risk-averse. The person who buys the platinum policy is probably very risk-averse, and they want maximum coverage, and they will get it. The person who buys the bronze policy, which covers 60% of the cost, is much skimpier, and you're on the hook for a lot more out-of-pocket costs, either through the deductible or the co-insurance or the co-pays, as well as the premium. And I think that people need to understand that it's the interplay of all those elements of the policy that determine your overall cost. It is just not the premium. It's the co-insurance, it's the co-pays, and the deductible, and the network. And you have to really look at all of those things and see what you're willing to give up if you have to give up something.
So I'm looking right now. She posted the options on her page, on her Facebook page. I'm looking right now, and it says bronze 60 PPO, silver 70 PPO. So does that mean that the plan would cover 60% of her costs or 70% of her costs?
Yeah.
Okay. So, I mean, these prices are so ridiculous. The 60%, again, is $775 a month. The 90% is $1,590. And, again, because these companies cannot say, well, you've got a pre-existing condition, we're not going to cover you. I mean, Trudy and Jordan, are you hearing from people who say, you know what, I've got issues, I go to the doctor a lot, I need coverage, and so they go with these platinum PPOs because they don't really have any other choice?
Well, I think
most
people.
Oh, go ahead. Yeah, I think that actually most people are going for the cheaper plans now, the bronze and the silver, because of the cost. And people are frustrated because, I mean, the people that we hear from often have come to conclude that these are basically catastrophic plans in one way or another. That, yes, they're protecting them if they have to have heart surgery, they're not going to have to sell their house. But for all the regular stuff, they're going to be paying, you know, $500, $600. $700 more out of pocket for the premiums every month. And then they're basically going to be self-insuring, paying for whenever they go to the doctor. So that's super frustrating. And, you know, it's not just for the people that don't qualify for subsidies. Because if you're, you know, Trudy mentioned, you know, that the top level that you get subsidy is $100,000 for a family of four. And if you're right below that, while you are capped, you still have to pay a significant amount of your income, almost 10%. And then on top of that, you also are vulnerable to these deductibles. So those people, too, can have, you know, 20% or more of their income going to their health care costs in a year.
And, you know, what's so frustrating about this, the $1,600 a month for health care. And Jordan, one of your colleagues at Kaiser Health News wrote a piece called Blue Shield Lifts the Veil on Executive Pay. Paul Markovich made $3.5 million in 2015, a 40% increase since he took the job in 2013. So the profits at these health insurance companies are incredibly high, and the CEO pay is in the millions.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's you know, executive pay is a huge issue, and particularly the differential from what, you know, regular people get paid and lower people get paid is a huge issue in all the industries. But, you know, a lot of the problem isn't just the insurers. You know, the medical device manufacturers, the hospitals, the doctors, they have margins that generally as an industry are higher than the insurers. And, you know, but they are, you don't see that because, you know, your intermediary is the insurer. And the other thing to remember, and I don't want to be an apologist for the industry, but, you know, providing the type of healthcare that we do in this country in terms of the sophistication of some of the devices, some of them unnecessary, but some of them necessary, the advancement of the technology is incredibly expensive. And you've got a population that's getting older, that's getting sicker. that's going to live longer and survive illnesses, so they'll have more chronic illnesses. All of those factors are the fundamental underlying drivers of costs. So, I mean, you could take that, you know, $3.5 million salary and you could cut it down to, you know, $300,000, but it's still not going to solve the fundamental structural problems that are leading to increased costs.
I think one other thing to remember in this market, the individual market, which is where these policies are, is that they're available to everyone now, regardless of what their health condition is. In the old days of the individual market, these policies were underwritten. And what that means that the insurer would very carefully scrutinize somebody's health records. And if they found any kind of pre-existing condition or anything that looked like might be a serious problem down the road, the person didn't get coverage. So the insurance companies will tell you that since they can no longer do this kind of underwriting, that they have to compensate for all of these sick people that are coming into the risk pool. And we do know that people with a lot of health problems now for the first time are able to get health insurance, and they are coming into the risk pool, and that really does boosts the outlay of the insurance company, and they've begun to price for that. And so they spread the cost of that all around because there's not, you know, they can't underwrite. So I think that there's some of that that's also included in the premiums that everybody is paying. It's, in the end, a very small risk pool. And if you talk about the employer market, where there's, you know, millions of people in the employer market, say, of a very large corporation, say, like the auto industry, or the, you know, name the industry, there's lots of people that are in the risk pool. And so you can kind of spread the risk around. And you can't do that in a market that has, what, 16 million, 17 million people in it. And that's been the big problem with trying to tinker with the individual market. And all of this was really predicted when the law passed, but everybody seemed to think that, well, it was somehow going to work out. And insurance-wise, insurance companies were going to do what they always had to do, and that was make money.
Mm. Well, we have an email from Jane who says, for heaven's sakes, I thought I was listening to a show about how to buy a sofa, not about such serious topics as Americans' health care. Can't we just catch up with the rest of the industrialized world and introduce universal health care ASAP? Well, a new Reuters survey finds that the vast majority of the country, 70%, now support Medicare for all. 85% of Democrats, 52% of Republicans. And we'll talk about that after a break. Today, we're talking about the Affordable Care Act. Open enrollment runs through December 15th. So now is the time to either get insurance, or maybe if you want to change your plan, find out what other options are available. As always, the prices are really across the board. Depending on what you can afford, you might get comprehensive care. Or if you can't, in some cases, $700 a month basically gives you catastrophic care. That's in Monterey County. Today we're joined by Trudy Lieberman, contributing editor for the Columbia Journalism Review, and Jordan Rao, senior correspondent for Kaiser Health News. They are independent of the Kaiser Family Foundation. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today we are talking about the Affordable Care Act. Open enrollment runs through December 15th. We're talking about it with Trudy Lieberman, contributing editor for the Columbia Journalism Review and lead writer for CJR's blog covering the healthcare fight. Jordan Rao is senior correspondent for Kaiser Health News, a nonprofit news service committed to in-depth coverage of healthcare policy, and it's editorially independent of the Kaiser Family Foundation. And if you'd like to join us, if you have any questions or comments about health insurance, if you have a plan under the ACA, how much is it? Is it good? And did you look this time around to see if anything changed, maybe if the price came down or if it's more comprehensive? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. We have an email from Ruby who says, how will the new tax structure change the medical deductions we can take? We've been told, as we're independent contractors, we can still claim all of our meds as deductions. Jordan, do you have information about that?
I don't, and I wouldn't want to guess.
Trudy, do you?
No, I don't either.
All right. Well, Ruby, we will look it up, and if we find an answer, we'll put a link at yourcallradio.org. Ruby had another question, and this is a really important one because the individual mandate will no longer be in effect as of January 1st. She says, is there still a fine charged on income tax if a person does not have health insurance? Trudy, do you want to take that one first? Talk about what that means.
I don't believe there is any more penalty for not having insurance. Jordan, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I think the mandate is gone,
right,
and no penalty.
Yeah. Right. And
yeah, that's right. In fact, that's exactly what they meant by getting rid of it, is that the IRS lowered the penalty to $0.
Well, this is significant. I mean, experts told U.S. News that the mandate may not have been a significant factor because the penalty wasn't significant, but a joint study released just yesterday from UCLA and Berkeley says that removing the individual mandate will grow the number of uninsured people in California alone by 800,000, and researchers expect that number to reach more than 4 million by 2023. Jordan, what do you think of these numbers?
Well, they're large, and there's two areas of concern. So there's what the numbers reflect, which is people that go without insurance, and that's obviously a big problem because you're back to where you were, square one. But the other problem is that everyone else's premiums and costs go up, and this is because of what Trudy was talking about earlier, the risk pool. So who's going to not get insurance? It's going to be people that are healthy, people that are young, people that don't think that they need any coverage. So who's left in the risk pool? It's the people that are using the medical services. So because of that, you're going to have to pay for all those medical services through premiums to a smaller group of people. And that is the big concern with the change in the individual mandate.
Well, and the other issue is that people just cannot afford it. I mean, even if you want the care, I was looking at what my friend in Monterey County posted, and she said these are her only four options in the entire county is from Blue Shield of California, starting at $775 a month. So I bet that so many people are going to say, there's no way I can afford this. I'm just not going to get insurance.
Well, I think that's
And people have done that. Have done that calculation even when there was a financial penalty, and
right,
said, well, if I'm going to pay $600 penalty, I'd rather pay that than pay, you know, $16,000 for a high deductible plan that I don't think I'm going to use. So, in a way, the fact that the penalty was so low before that it actually sometimes made financial sense for people to take the penalty may, to some extent, ameliorate massive changes from this. And I just don't know, you know. I mean, obviously, projections are projections. But in general, there have been a lot of concern that people opting out of this system were going to unsettle this market and collapse it, and that hasn't quite happened so far. But what has happened, obviously, is that the premiums have gone up a lot faster than the architects of the plan of this the whole law wanted.
Trudy, what would you add?
Well, I think we don't really know the conclusion of this experiment. I like to call it an experiment in tinkering around with this market, the individual market. Many of us, when the law was being debated, wrote and had serious reservations for all of these reasons that we've been talking about today. Much of this was known. These things could have happened, could happen. And people who knew the industry certainly feared that this would happen. But in the exuberance and excitement of being able to pass something, finally, after however many years even trying to fix this market, a lot of people really weren't listening or thinking about the consequences later on. And I think some of those chickens actually have been coming home to roost. And I must say, as a journalist watching this, I'm really not surprised at what I'm seeing, because this was all predictable. And I think that there were some of us who were trying to warn people about this, and it was very difficult because there was such momentum in the media and by the advocacy community that was really behind this, and a lot of other people who really signed on to this, that this was going to fix our problems, without really looking at the structure of health insurance and what was likely to happen. And you know, it's happening, and how it's going to be resolved, I don't really know. Mm. But I know that families like you believe that this is too much, they're not going to be able to pay it, and having a lot of families go bare is not really the answer, because it's going to mess up the risk pool for those who remain, as Jordan explained. But it's also going to hurt those families that have made that decision if something unforeseen has happened to them. Mm. And I think people don't understand that these kind of unforeseen health events do happen, and they happen more often than you think they do. And they happen to people who are healthy, who think they're healthy. And so I think we're unable to think about the risk that we face when we don't buy insurance.
Well, we have a few callers on the line. Thank you for the email, Ruby. Oh, I should say that Ruby ends her message by saying, we are very grateful for Medicare. Cannot imagine how people over 65 could live without it. I'm planning to do a Medicare show soon because I've been caregiving for someone who has Medicare, and wow, I'm glad she has it, but it is hard to get appointments, and not everyone takes Medicare. So I definitely want to do a show about that. Thank you, Ruby. Let's go next to Robert in San Francisco. Hi, Robert. Welcome to the show.
Hi. I have a question and a comment. The comment is that when you turn 65, if you have Medicaid under Obamacare, there are expanded rules that allow you to have over $2,000 in assets and still get Medicaid. Those are the new rules under Obamacare. But when you turn 65, you go back to the old rules. So if you have over $2,000 in assets, you're thrown off Medicaid, like I was. So,
wow. $2,000 in assets? That's the rule?
Yeah.
How are you... $2,000? I mean...
So you have to spend down.
Wow.
So, which is too low, you know?
So you were kicked off of Medicaid because you have more than $2,000 in assets.
Right, and to me, I think that might be illegal age discrimination, but the law is so complicated, you know, and I haven't read the Supreme Court decision to see if there's anything in the law that allows them to do this without it being age discrimination.
So if they kick you off Medicaid, were you able to sign up for Medicare?
I get Medicare, yeah.
And
but
what
I
is
still
the
need the Medicaid because of the deductibles and all that.
Oh, okay, because I was going to ask you, Robert, what is the difference since you've had Medicaid and Medicare? What are the major differences?
Well, I'm just getting my Medicare card in 2 weeks, so I don't know yet.
Well, Robert, stay on the line in case you have a follow-up question. Trudy, can you talk with Robert? I mean, $2,000 was the limit for Medicaid, and then after he turned 65, he got kicked off. Is that legal? Is that how it works?
I don't know. I can't speak to, he's obviously talking about California Medi-Cal, and I don't really know the rules under that program. I think he probably needs to go to one of the high cap counselors in the state and talk to them about it, because they're in the best position to help him.
Jordan, yeah. Do you have any information?
I don't have any specific. I mean, on a broad policy level, it might seem like it makes it's understandable because once you're eligible for Medicare, that's going to be covering a lot of your costs, and so they only limit to a very small select people who can get both. The big problem is in there are certain things that Medicaid will cover that Medicare will not, and I'll give you one example that's probably probably the most prominent is nursing home coverage. So if you go into a nursing home from a hospital, Medicare will pay for all or most of that for 100 days. But after that, Medicare does not pay for that, and Medicaid does.
Hmm.
So what happens to a lot of people is that they are on Medicare. They go into the nursing home, and they stay there because they're old and they're very frail. 100 days comes, and now they either have to start spending down their life savings or find someone else to pay for their nursing home care and stay. So there are a bunch of little gaps and things like that where people fall in between the cracks in the system.
What if they don't have savings and they don't have family members? What happens?
Well, if they don't have savings, then they qualify for Medicaid. And then their stay is paid for by Medicaid. So it's actually in some ways, I wouldn't say better, but you do get insurance if you have nothing.
It's crazy to me, though, that the limit is 2,000 in assets. I mean, some people, that's barely rent and groceries for so many people. I mean, that's just, why can't that number go up? It seems like it should be much higher.
Well,
yeah,
I
agree with
Trudy.
Trudy?
I think the asset limits are low in most of the states. I mean, I can't speak for all the states, but I do know that they're not particularly generous.
Wow. That doesn't make sense to me at all. Robert, have you called a counselor to talk about this?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and I'm pretty sure of what I'm telling you. One of the reasons I called is because almost no one knows about this until they get caught in it, and so people are in the middle of root canals and procedures, and they're thrown off Medicaid, and then they basically you're going to get the bill,
wow.
And to go into, have this medical debt, for the rest of their lives, and they don't even know that it's happening. So that's one of the reasons I wanted to call. The other was because I wanted to bring some public awareness because I'm not sure it's legal to do that.
Well, if it is, it's not right. I mean, in this state of California that's run by Democrats, it's super. We have a supermajority again in Sacramento. So people should put pressure on politicians to change this number so people do not get kicked off Medi-Cal. I'm dealing with health issues in my own family, and this issue just makes me very angry. I wanted to give out the phone number if anyone else needs a counselor, if they'd like to talk about their options, what's legal, what's not, and that number nationwide, or I'm sorry, this is just California, but we'll find another one for nationwide. California is 800-434-0222, 800-434-0222. And thank you for calling, Robert. I'm so sorry this is happening. We're going to do like a week-long series in January on this inhumane healthcare system we have, and we'll definitely talk about why people are being kicked off of Medicaid. So thank you. We wish we had more answers, but we'll definitely look into this. Let's go next to Mary Louise in Solano. Hi, Mary Louise.
Yeah. Hi, me again. Listen, I just wanted to comment on that issue about Medi-Cal and Medicare, and I'm covered by both, and I've had numerous cancer operations, some very, very difficult and very costly. And thank goodness that I was covered by Medicare and Medi-Cal because everything was taken care of, including my Hep C. All of that was taken care of without a penny from my pocket.
Good.
That, to me, I wouldn't be alive. I wouldn't be alive at all.
Wow.
And I'm facing yet another cancer operation. I have lung cancer. But it's very small, and because of all my medical care, I get regular scans, and they can catch it when it's tiny. The flip side is we can't have a cent over $2,000 in our account.
Wow.
My partner and I have not gotten married after, even though it's legal, California, with same-sex marriages, precisely because of this issue. Precisely. We're both on Medicare and Medi-Cal. and we can't have 1 cent. You have no idea how insecure that makes us feel. If anything happens to us, we don't have the money to move into a new apartment. We have, you know what I mean?
Wow.
So we literally hide our money under the mattress. Mm. Literally.
Is this?
And this has been going on for years. And this is a law in relation to anybody on Medi-Cal. Anybody on Medi-Cal. This, you can't have $2,000 in assets over $2,000. And it's also for food stamps. I don't know if you know that. It's the same law. You can't have both. So you know what they're saying. You know, this was something that Clinton, you know, with, and Reagan, which is, welfare queens. Mm. This is the result of that dynamic.
You know, I need to look into this more, Mary Louise, but this 2000 in assets, are you talking about just a bank account? What if you own a home? Does that also, is that also included?
No, no, you can own your home.
Okay.
But you can't sell it and get a new one.
Okay, so 2000
yeah,
in the bank.
You can, if you've had your home, you can own your home. But how do you pay a mortgage if you have less than 2000 in the bank?
This just makes absolutely no sense.
No, so it's geared to keeping poor people very, very poor.
Right.
And this has always been a huge issue for me. I'm a Buddhist and I chant about it every single day. Because this is something that needs to be brought to everybody's attention. This is how we keep the poor poor.
Mm.
You know, this is how we do it.
Well,
and it's horrible, but it's a trap. But I need the medical care.
Right.
So I play by the rules. I need it. Without it, I'd be dead.
Well, thank you for sharing, Mary Louise. Would you stay on the line and give our producer, Laura, your phone number so we can get in touch? And maybe have you on in a future show, because we definitely are going to do a follow-up on this and find out if these requirements are similar in other states, because this needs to get so much more attention. Thank you for calling in. Let's go next to Robert in San Francisco. Hi, Robert. Do we have Robert? Okay. Let's try Kevin in Oakland. Hi, Kevin.
Hi. I have a case where I was signing up for a health care program after my COBRA expired. And I went directly through Kaiser, talked to their sales agent. They promised me a price. If I signed up by October 15th, it was good through the end of next year, end of 2019. And then when it comes down to it, they don't return phone calls. And I find out that their verbal promise is not valid. What can I do when they give me incorrect information?
Jordan, do you know?
I don't. I mean, the two things that I would say is that, you know, if you're eligible for a subsidy, you should go through the exchange so that you can get, you know, the prices are preset. And so those are already, they're listed, they're set by law or by arrangement with the state. And that people who are off the exchanges tend to have a lot of success working with individual brokers who know the system, who are very reliable. You know, this is, as we've been discussing, it's a super hard thing to negotiate on your own. So one way or the other, having, you know, either the organization or a broker helping you makes a big difference.
Yeah, this was just the Kaiser salesperson who... There's website information, but they promise something over the phone that they don't hold to. And I'm not qualified for subsidies, so I haven't.
Well, one thing I would be careful of, I don't know whether you're talking about a Medicare situation, but one thing I have heard that has happened in California and other states where people don't have very many options is that their employer automatically, when they turn 65, is signing them up for Medicare Advantage plans. And they really don't know that they are being signed up for a Medicare Advantage plan. I do believe Kaiser Health News wrote about this. And what happens is that these people end up in a Medicare Advantage plan. Maybe it works for them for a while, maybe it doesn't. But down the road, if it turns out that it doesn't work for them for whatever reason, they don't have any options in California to go back to traditional Medicare and to buy a supplemental policy. There are only four states in the country, New York, Connecticut, Maine, and Massachusetts, that allow people to go back and forth to a Medicare supplement policy to supplement Medicare. And so your options are very limited. And not too long ago, I met someone at one of the high-cap offices in Contra Costa County and found that these people were out of luck. The man wanted out of his Medicare Advantage plan because he had Parkinson's, and he wanted to go to different doctors and get more specialists. And I guess he was having trouble doing that, so he wanted to go back to traditional Medicare. And he was counseled that, yes, he could go back to traditional Medicare, but he couldn't buy a supplement, so that he didn't have that additional protection that, say, people in New York have. So I think people better watch to see what their employers are doing when they reach retirement age. And if they're automatically being signed up for a Medicare Advantage plan versus a traditional supplement and traditional Medicare, and make their choices based on facts and what's good for them, not just an automatic sell-up by their employer.
I was trying to follow you there, Trudy.
I
mean,
yeah, I know, it's complicated.
This is so complicated.
Yeah, it's very complicated. And, you know, when you do your program on Medicare, maybe we should go into it.
Yeah, we know we should. I mean, it's just, we were getting so many emails from people. One from Alex: we're a family of four living in SF on $60,000 a year. ACA was a great boon, provided better coverage. With the birth of our second child, we went to a single income. Our kids are covered by expanded Medi-Cal, but we've got Kaiser $1,600 a month on a silver plan with an $1,100 subsidy. This listener writes, I'm looking for work, but I'll have to turn down jobs that don't provide comprehensive care. We absolutely need Medicare for all, so people like me are not discouraged from taking jobs because it will cost us too much to do so. Well, we're definitely going to do a series, and the thing I've been wanting to do for a while is to do shows about countries that have comprehensive care and bring on people and just ask them questions. How do they do it? What's covered? How much do you pay? What are your taxes? So we'll definitely do that in January. Trudy Lieberman is contributing editor for the Columbia Journalism Review and lead writer for CJR's blog covering the healthcare fight. Trudy, thank you so much for all of your work. We'd love to have you back.
Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you. Jordan Rao is senior correspondent for Kaiser Health News, a nonprofit that covers healthcare policy and politics. It is independent from the Kaiser Family Foundation. Jordan, thank you for your work, and thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. And thank you for all of your phone calls and emails. If you have any other stories to share about healthcare, or if there is a healthcare issue that you think deserves more attention, and we can add it to the week-long series that we're planning in January, please email us your call at kalw.org. This is such an important issue that we will continue to cover. Thanks to Laura Wenis for producing today's show, Kevin Vance, our studio engineer, and thanks for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.